November 25, 1991, Middle Township, New Jersey. 11-year-old Mark Heimball leaves his residence in order to watch firefighters extinguishing a brush fire, but he never returns home, and a search turns up Mark's left shoe on a nearby beach. Over 1 year later, a witness tells police that a man named Thomas Buttcavage screened a video of himself sexually assaulting Mark before he confessed to his murder. While Buttcavage eventually goes to prison for other sex crimes, the incriminating videotape is never found, and no evidence links him to Mark's disappearance. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be covering a troubling missing children's case, the 1991 disappearance of 11-year-old Mark Heimbaugh. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Julie Highland, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Julie. This is a recurring monthly contest which we've been holding for nearly 5 years now, and if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. Anyway, the disappearance of Mark Heimbaugh was the case that Julie requested I cover when she originally entered this contest, and this is definitely an ideal time to put together an episode. Late last year, to commemorate the 30th anniversary of Mark's disappearance, Richard McHale, a retired detective who was once the former lead investigator on this case, released a book titled Where is Mark? The Abduction of Mark Heimbaugh. McHale revealed a lot of new information which had never been made public before, and as a result, this story has been pushed back into the spotlight. But I'm going to warn you right up front. Where is Mark is one of the most disturbing true crime books I've ever read, as it contains graphic descriptions of the sexual abuse of children. I'm certainly not going to go into graphic detail here, and will try to handle this material as sensitively as possible, but there are some troubling things I will have to address. All cases involving missing and murdered children are difficult, but this is one of the more disturbing cases we've ever featured on The Trail Went Cold. Mark Heimbaugh would disappear after leaving his residence to visit the scene of a brush fire, and various eyewitnesses would place him in the company of an unidentified young girl and multiple unidentified males. The most promising suspect in this case is a sex offender named Thomas Buttcavage, who allegedly possessed a videotape which featured him sexually assaulting Mark, though this tape has never been found. However, the biggest revelation in Richard McHale's book are a number of troubling allegations against Mark's father, which we'll discuss later on in this episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the disappearance of Mark Heimbaugh. Our story begins in 1991 in Middle Township, New Jersey, a township located in Cape May County on the shores of Delaware Bay, which had a population of around 15,000 people at that time. Our central figure is 11-year-old Mark Heimbaugh, who lives with his mother, Maureen Heimbaugh, and his 12-year-old brother, Matthew, at a residence on Sunray Road in the Delhaven neighborhood. Maureen is currently separated from Mark's father, Jody Heimbaugh, who moved out of the house 8 months earlier, and the couple are in the midst of divorce proceedings. Jody currently lives in an apartment in Cape May, and his two sons sometimes make weekend visits there. Due to his inquisitive nature, Mark is nicknamed Curious George, and is a 6th grade student at Cape May County Alternative Middle School. He has been classified as being emotionally disturbed and possibly having obsessive-compulsive disorder, which make him prone to throwing tantrums and having angry outbursts. But for the past 2 years, Mark has been taking Prozac and undergoing talk therapy, which has caused his behavioral issues to improve. At around 3:20 p.m. on the afternoon of Monday, November the 25th, 3 days before Thanksgiving, Mark had just arrived home from school when he saw smoke in the distance and heard the sound of fire trucks arriving in order to extinguish a brush fire which was taking place in a marsh about a quarter of a mile away on Bayshore Road. At around the same time, one of the Heimbaugh's neighbors stopped by their house because her car was ready to be picked up at a nearby repair shop, and she asked if Maureen would give her a ride. Maureen agreed to the request, and she also gave Mark permission to walk to the scene of the fire. As she climbed into her car with the neighbor and drove away, Maureen spotted Mark near the driveway and said goodbye to him, unaware that this would be the last time she ever saw her son. The trip to the repair shop should have only taken about 10 minutes, but the brush fire prompted police to set up a roadblock on Bayshore Road, and traffic was rerouted and forced to take a detour through the Delhaven neighborhood. As a result, Maureen's trip wound up taking over 40 minutes, and when she arrived home, Mark was not there. Mark's brother Matthew soon returned home from school, but by the time he sat down to have dinner with his mother, Mark had still not returned, and it was getting dark outside. Maureen became concerned enough to start searching the neighborhood for Mark, but when she failed to find him by 6 p.m., she contacted the Middle Township Police Department to report him missing. A massive search effort was launched for Mark, and at around 9 p.m., his left shoe was discovered on Sunray Beach, located about 75 yards from his residence. The shoe was an L.A. Gear sneaker which had once belonged to Mark's brother, and both Matthew and Maureen positively identified it. After suffering a fracture in his left foot, which required him to wear a cast, Mark had borrowed Matthew's shoes since they were a bigger size and easier to walk around in with his injury. Even though Mark's cast had recently been removed, he was still wearing the LA Gear sneakers on the day he went missing. Mark's footprints, one of which appeared to be a shoe print, and the other a regular foot or sock print, were also found in the sand at Sunray Beach above the tide line. As they went along, they seemed to change into two bare footprints, as if Mark had also taken off his right shoe, but the shoe itself was never found. The footprints faded away when they reached the dry sand, but police bloodhounds continued to track Mark's scent to the pavement at a corner of Roosevelt Boulevard before losing it, which implied that Mark might have gotten into a vehicle. Investigators do not believe Mark ran away of his own volition or drowned after entering Delaware Bay, and suspected that he was the victim of an abduction. Once Mark's disappearance started generating publicity, multiple eyewitnesses would come forward who placed him in the presence of various individuals that afternoon. 4 teenagers would confirm that they saw Mark show up near Bayshore Road to watch the firefighters dousing the brush fire before he left and headed back home. Due to the detour caused by the fire, a married couple named Josh and Sarah Morgan were parked in traffic with their children on Delaware Avenue and told investigators they saw Mark walking past their vehicle. While this was happening, a light-colored Ford Escort station wagon with a luggage rack pulled up behind the Morgans, and they noticed a man open the passenger side door and step outside the vehicle while Mark passed by. Even though the Morgans could not hear the conversation, they said that the man said something to Mark, who replied before he continued walking. The man then climbed back into the station wagon, which immediately turned around and started heading down Delaware Road in Mark's direction. The Morgans described the man as being unshaven, with dark, shoulder-length hair, thick-framed glasses, and he was dressed in a flannel shirt and corduroy pants. They did not get a good enough look at the station wagon's driver to provide a detailed description, only that he was a thin man with pulled-back, stringy blonde hair who was smoking a cigarette. A composite sketch was created for the other man, though it would not be circulated publicly for over a year and a half. At around 4 p.m., there would be another eyewitness sighting of Mark from an attendant at Cape May County Park South, located about a quarter mile away from Mark's residence. The attendant knew Mark personally and immediately recognized him, and said that he was in the company of a young girl. She was described as being around 9 or 10 years old, 4 feet tall, weighing approximately 70 to 75 pounds, and was dressed in a three-quarter-length dark blue ski parka with a hunter orange stripe on the back. Even though Mark did have a girlfriend at the time named Robin, this girl was definitely not her, and she and Mark were both seen crossing the street and heading into the park. While a composite sketch was created and circulated for the girl, she never came forward and has not been identified. This is believed to be the last confirmed sighting of Mark, but two teenagers also reported seeing him with another unidentified man in the park that afternoon. This man was described as being around 5'6" and in his mid-20s, with brown hair and bushy eyebrows. Once again, a composite sketch was created for this man and circulated, but this did not occur until after the two witnesses were re-interviewed right before the one-year anniversary of Mark's disappearance. If you search online, you'll also find a composite sketch for yet another unidentified male described as being between 30 to 35 years old, about 5'8 or 5'9 and weighing 150 pounds, and he also had dark reddish-brown hair and a ponytail and a scruffy, unkempt appearance. However, I cannot find any specific details about when or where the sighting of this man took place. Mark's disappearance would garner a lot of publicity and was featured on a number of nationally televised shows, including America's Most Wanted. Mark's father, Jody Heimbaugh, helped organize a foundation called Friends of Mark to spread awareness of his son's disappearance, and they put up a $10,000 reward for information leading to Mark's return. When heavyweight boxer Riddick Bowe learned about the case, he publicly stated that he would add $15,000 of his own money to the reward fund if Mark was returned safely. 3 weeks after Mark's disappearance, Bowe was involved in a highly publicized boxing match at the Trump Convention Center in Atlantic City. During the pre-fight press conference, Bowe had the words, "Help us find Mark," as well as Mark's photo, inscribed on his sweatshirt while he discussed the case, and when he came out to the ring for his bout, those same words and Mark's face were featured on his robe. At one point, the Heimbaughs approached Unsolved Mysteries about the possibility of featuring Mark's case on the show, but were rejected after being told that the circumstances of his disappearance could not be reenacted with much drama. But while we're on the subject, Dorothy Allison, a prominent psychic from Nutley, New Jersey, who was once featured on Unsolved Mysteries, was brought in to assist the investigation into Mark's disappearance. However, Jody Heimbaugh was not particularly impressed by Allison's work, as she produced no useful information and even brought along a Japanese film crew to document her work on the case. Jody would later say that all the false hopes and leads provided by various psychics over the years caused him to be hospitalized for anxiety attacks on two separate occasions. Believe it or not, in June of 1993, another crime involving children took place in the Delhaven neighborhood, only a few houses down from where the Heimbaughs live. A woman named Joanna Cortez and her live-in boyfriend, Harry Conrad, were arrested on charges of child endangerment and criminal restraint for abusing Cortez's 11-year-old granddaughter and imprisoning her inside a closet. They both received a sentence of 5 years probation for their crimes, but even though Mark had once been playmates with the victim, no link could be found between the two cases. But around this same time period, investigators would go public about a shocking new development which had taken place 3 months earlier. On February the 14th, a male sex worker named Daniel Call claimed that he met up with a regular client of his named Thomas Buttcabbage, a 26-year-old self-employed computer consultant who lived in the unincorporated community of Havertown, Pennsylvania. They both went to Buttcabbage's apartment, where they smoked marijuana and watched pornography together, until Buttcabbage decided to play a videotape which showed him with a red-headed, freckled young boy. According to Call, the boy on the tape was shackled, handcuffed, and gagged, and appeared to be very frightened before Buttcabbage sexually assaulted him. Since he had previously seen missing persons flyers of Mark Heimbaugh, Call immediately noticed the resemblance and asked Buttcabbage if the boy was Mark. Buttcabbage confirmed that it was, and stated that he often liked to drive outside the area where he lived, sometimes as far as 100 miles, in order to abduct children off the street and take them somewhere to be abused before he killed them. He claimed to have killed at least 5 or 6 kids before disposing of their bodies and had done the same thing to Mark. Buttcabbage also said that he had deliberately planted Mark's sneaker on Sunray Beach in order to confuse the investigation. Buttcabbage told Call that he ordinarily worked with someone who helped him acquire these kids, but since this guy kept screwing up and needed to be replaced, he asked Call if he would like to join him and take his place. Call declined the offer and soon left Buttcabbage's apartment, before he went to the police to inform them about what happened. A warrant was soon issued to search Buttcabbage's apartment, and he would be arrested and charged with possession of drugs and drug paraphernalia after marijuana was found on the premises. Two separate searches were performed of the apartment, and while they turned up a number of pornographic videotapes and magazines, along with items such as handcuffs, leg shackles, and ball gags, the alleged videotape of Butkavage sexually assaulting a boy could not be found. When investigators asked Butkavage about the tape, he simply replied, quote, "You won't find it." Butkavage was also given a polygraph, which showed that he was being deceptive in some of his answers to key questions about the disappearance of Mark Heimbaugh. Even though no evidence could be found to link Butkavage to Mark's case, investigators were struck by the close resemblance between Butkavage and the composite sketch of the long-haired man in a station wagon, whom the Morgan family had seen speaking to Mark on the day he went missing. For the first time, the composite sketch of this man was circulated throughout the media. While Daniel Call's name was not published in the newspapers at that time, he decided to go public and do an interview with NBC 10 Philadelphia in August of 2015. Call was terminally ill, but he still stuck to his original story and continued to maintain that Mark was the young boy he had seen being assaulted in the video. As for Thomas Butkavage, he would relocate to the town of Cochranville and was arrested again in September of 1998 and charged with 159 counts of involuntary deviant sexual intercourse and 3 counts each of sexual abuse of children, indecent assault, and corruption of minors. Over the course of the previous 2 years, Butkavage had habitually groomed and abused 3 underage boys, but while a search of his possessions uncovered photographs and videotapes of this abuse, there was still no trace of the alleged videotape of him and Mark. Butkavage wound up receiving a 36-year prison sentence for these crimes and is currently incarcerated at the State Correctional Institution in Greaterford. Another odd development took place at around 3:45 a.m. on December the 27th, 2010, when the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children received an anonymous call on their tip line from a man calling from a payphone outside a Sunoco gas station in Philadelphia's Port Richmond neighborhood. The man identified himself as the quote-unquote son of the witness of the crime and said that Mark's abductor was named Gilbert Patrick Marie. The Middle Township Police Department received an identical call that very same night, but investigators could find no record of anyone named Gilbert Patrick Marie or anything similar. Edited audio of the phone call was released publicly for the first time in June of 2015, in hopes that someone might identify the caller's voice, and while investigators have asked him to come forward and provide more information, he never has. As for Mark's mother, Maureen Heimbaugh, she has continued to live at the same address and keep the same phone number, on the chance that Mark was still alive and attempted to contact her. Maureen has done a number of interviews in recent years to continue spreading awareness about her son's case, but after 3 decades, Mark Heimbaugh continues to remain a missing person. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So now it's time to talk more about the recently released book, Where is Mark? The Abduction of Mark Heimbaugh, written by retired detective Richard McHale. And while some of the material I've shared thus far has already been pretty disturbing, I must warn you that I'm going to talk more about the sexual abuse of children. I mentioned in the intro that Where is Mark? Is one of the more disturbing true crime books I've ever read, and since it goes into rather graphic detail about child sexual abuse, I would honestly say read at your own risk before recommending the book to anyone. I will definitely not go into the same level of graphic detail here, and I'm only going to share the most basic, necessary information, but there are some topics that need to be addressed. Before I started working on this episode, I only had limited knowledge of this case, but pretty much assumed that Thomas Butkavage was most likely responsible for Mark's disappearance, and they just didn't have the evidence to prove it. And that very well may be true, but after reading the book, I've started to wonder if there's a lot more to this story, as there are some pretty shocking allegations about Mark's father, Jody Heimbaugh. I always recommend that if you're putting together a podcast episode and a book has been published about the featured case, always use that as your last source for your research. If you gather all your material from other sources first, you can then use the book to flesh out all the important details, and it doesn't feel like you're doing a carbon copy of the author's original work. At the time Mark went missing, I knew that Jody and Maureen Heimbaugh were separated and living apart, but if you were to go through many of the news articles about this case from the 1990s, you get the impression that Jody was a tireless advocate for his missing son. For years, Jody seemed to function as the family's official spokesperson, as he was constantly spreading awareness through his Friends of Mark Foundation. By comparison, Maureen pretty much shied away from the spotlight, as she had to devote a lot of her energy to taking care of her other son, Matthew. Well, in recent years, Maureen has been the one who has been doing interviews and making media appearances to share Mark's story, while Jody has pretty much dropped off the face of the earth, and to put it mildly, Richard McHale's book does not portray him in a flattering light. For starters, Jody was portrayed as a very detached father who seemed to get along well with Matthew, but he did not have a good relationship with Mark, and showed very little patience for the behavioral problems the boy experienced. When Mark went missing, Matthew phoned up Jody at his residence in Cape May to inform him about what was happening, but Jody was more concerned with performing at a dinner theater show that night as part of a barbershop quartet. After Mark failed to turn up, Matthew phoned his father again and had to convince him to come to their home in Delhaven. When Jody finally showed up there at around 9:30 p.m., he only stayed for a very short time and seemed much more concerned with comforting Matthew's girlfriend rather than his own family. He soon went back home without participating in the search for Mark or being interviewed by police. When detectives traveled to Cape May to interview Jody the following morning, they were surprised to find that he had shown up to work at his job at a printing store and did not seem overly concerned about his missing son. It seemed like Jody finally took an interest in the case when the Friends of Mark Foundation was formed and he became a professional fundraiser to raise money for the search effort. When Riddick Bowe held a press conference before his big fight and pledged to add $15,000 to the reward fund, Jody was right there beside him and even said a few words. In January of 1992, John Walsh, the host of America's Most Wanted, was a keynote speaker at a memorial service for slain law enforcement officers, which was held at Trump Plaza in Atlantic City. As you probably know, John Walsh became a major advocate for victims of crime after his 6-year-old son Adam was abducted and murdered in 1981. He would mention Mark Heimbaugh during his speech at this event, as well as provide a shout-out to Jody, who was in the audience. Afterward, Walsh invited Jody to spend some time with him and shared advice about how to handle the public spotlight when you're the parent of a missing or murdered child. But while Jody would spend the next few years being a public spokesman and advocate for Mark, the implication provided by Richard McHale in the Where Is Mark book is that Jody only had an interest in doing so if it meant earning money for his own financial gain as well as attention for himself, and he did not show much grief for his missing son. At the very end of the book, McHale claims that he was approached by an anonymous woman who shared details about a shocking conversation she had with Jody in 1995. According to the woman, Jody told her that he knew Thomas Buttcavage was the person who murdered his son, but he didn't have much desire to see the case solved, as he considered Mark to be his quote-unquote logo and quote-unquote advertisement. Jody supposedly stated, quote, "They will never find Mark's remains. Anyone who tries either gives up or goes crazy. It's just what I want. I just want to make my millions." End quote. Well, needless to say, this information does not paint Jody in a flattering light, but it's nowhere near as disturbing as the book's allegations about his behavior around children. I will state right up front that Jody Heimbaugh has never been charged or convicted of any crimes, and I'm not going to go into any specific graphic details, but the book paints him as having an extensive history of acting inappropriately around kids, including allegations that he molested some of his nieces. I mentioned earlier that at the time of his disappearance, Mark had a girlfriend named Robin, who was also 11 years old, and sometimes accompanied Mark on his weekend visits to his father's apartment. When she was first interviewed by police, Robin mentioned that she believed Jody was creepy and had personally witnessed him hurt Mark by doing such things as grabbing him by the hair and pulling him through the hallway or slamming him against the wall. Robin also told investigators that 2 weeks before Mark disappeared, they had been out walking together and thought they were being followed by a light brown car, and Mark said that he had seen this same car following a school bus on his ride home. Well, many years later, after Robin reached adulthood, it sounds like she finally decided to confide in Richard McHale about a traumatic event which took place during this time period. An entire chapter of the book describes an incredibly disturbing incident from June of 1991, where Jody forced Mark and Robin to perform sexual acts on each other at his apartment while he videotaped them. An unidentified male friend of Jody's was also there watching them, and he proceeded to sexually assault Robin. After it was all over, Jody told Robin that he would kill her and her family if she told anyone about what happened. I have to tell you that the book describes this event in much more graphic detail than it should have, and it was so sickening to read that this marked one of the rare times where I wanted to completely abandon my work on this podcast episode because I wasn't sure I could stomach this case anymore. But at the same time, the level of detail gives off the impression that there's no way Robin could be making this story up, even though the incident took place over 30 years ago. Mark and Robin apparently had to endure this abuse on multiple occasions, and Robin now claims that before he left on his final weekend visit with his father, Mark told her that he was planning to go to the police and tell them about everything that Jody had done to them, and he would attempt to collect evidence at his father's apartment. It's also worth noting that when Jody dropped Mark off at his mother's residence at the end of the weekend, Maureen noticed Jody give Mark an affectionate hug before they parted ways. Given Jody's hostile relationship with his son, Mark found this very unusual and out of character for him. Since Mark went missing the very next day, Maureen now wonders if perhaps Jody was giving Mark a goodbye hug because he knew he would never see him again. I do believe that Jody is still alive today, but he has completely disappeared from the spotlight and has never publicly commented on any of these horrific allegations that were made against him in the book. I've also never seen Maureen comment on them either, but she did do an interview alongside Richard McHale on the True Crime Daily podcast last November, right around the time the book was released. The implication seems to be that Jody may not have been personally responsible for Mark's disappearance, but associated himself with sexual predators who were capable of harming his son, and he may have known the truth about what happened to Mark all along. The first two-thirds of the Where is Mark book spend a lot of time casting suspicion on Jody until it starts focusing attention on Thomas Buttcavage and the alleged videotape of him sexually assaulting Mark. Well, it turns out that Jody had a connection to Buttcavage, though it was a very tentative one. During this time period, Buttcavage used to have sex with a man who had a roommate that just happened to be the son of one of the members of Jody's barbershop quartet. So my initial impression about this case was that Mark was the victim of an opportunistic predator and just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, but all of the new information shared in the book completely threw me for a loop. It almost gives off the impression that there was an organized pedophile ring in the area, and Mark's abduction was a planned, coordinated effort. We know that he vanished shortly after leaving his home to go watch firefighters extinguish a nearby brush fire, and given how this forced police to divert traffic through Mark's neighborhood, you can see how a predator might have crossed paths with Mark by pure chance. But the alternate explanation is that someone set the fire for the express purpose of luring Mark out of his house, and while that sounds a little elaborate, I don't think it was ever conclusively determined how exactly that fire was started. It's been verified that Mark made it to the scene of the fire and was heading back home when he disappeared, and composite sketches were created for no less than 3 men and 1 girl who were supposedly seen with Mark during that time period. We've had separate sketches of a male in his mid-20s with brown hair and bushy eyebrows, as well as another man in his 30s with a ponytail, but these sightings aren't discussed much these days and are not even mentioned in Richard McHale's book. It seems like they have taken a backseat to the sighting from the Morgan family, who claimed they saw a long-haired man with glasses climbing out the passenger side of a Ford Escort station wagon and speaking to Mark as he walked past him, before the vehicle turned around and started driving in Mark's direction. The long-haired man bears a striking resemblance to Thomas Buttcavage, and as someone who has researched a lot of cold cases with composite sketches of unidentified individuals, this might be one of the closest matches I've ever seen between a sketch and a potential suspect. However, there are a lot of complications here. Even though the Morgans shared this story with the authorities almost immediately after Mark went missing, the composite sketch of the man from the station wagon was not circulated publicly for over a year and a half after Buttcavage became a person of interest. Before that, it seems like investigators placed more credence in the sighting from the 2 teenagers who claimed they saw Mark in Cape May County Park South with the brown-haired man with bushy eyebrows, as his sketch was circulated in November of 1992 on the one-year anniversary of Mark's disappearance. That would make sense, as we also had an eyewitness sighting of Mark entering the same park that afternoon alongside an unidentified girl, though I don't get the impression that the 2 teens reported seeing a girl with Mark and the man. And of course, the sighting of the girl is one of the most puzzling aspects of this case, as she has never come forward or been identified, even though a composite sketch was circulated for her, and Middle Township was described as being one of those close, tight-knit communities where everyone knew everybody else. I wondered if perhaps the park attendant who provided that sighting might have been mistaken, but he claimed that he personally knew Mark, whose red hair and freckles made him a pretty distinct-looking boy. The attendant had also seen Mark and Robin at the park together on previous occasions, and he knew that this particular girl was not Robin. It seems like investigators found the attendant's sighting to be credible, but the issue is that it would have taken place after the Morgans saw Mark passing by the long-haired man in the station wagon. So when and where did Mark meet up with this girl, and how did she fit into the whole thing? Did she compel Mark to divert himself from his route back home and go to the park? The most prominent theory is that the girl did not live in the area and may have been another abused or abducted child who was used to lure Mark to his kidnapper. But if the man in the station wagon was Thomas Buttcabbage, he was last seen heading in Mark's direction and could have easily abducted him without going through the ruse of using a girl as a diversion. According to the Morgans, the station wagon guy said something to Mark as he walked past him, but they couldn't hear what it was. It could have been as simple as asking Mark about the fire or why traffic was backed up, but perhaps he said something which convinced Mark to walk to Cape May County Park South. And of course, an additional complication in this case is the discovery of Mark's left sneaker at Sunray Beach, because even though the beach was located only 75 yards from his residence, it was also a half mile in the opposite direction of the park. So if Mark was abducted at the park, how did his shoe wind up at the beach? Well, the obvious answer is that someone deliberately planted it there in order to throw off the investigation, and Thomas Buttcabbage supposedly admitting to doing just that during his conversation with Daniel Call over 1 year later. But even so, how does that explain the presence of Mark's footprints in the wet sand? While it's tempting to believe that the perpetrator could have used the shoe to create those prints and cause confusion, the issue is that a number of them appeared to be bare or sock footprints created by a child who was not wearing a shoe. Since Mark had recently worn a cast because of a fracture in his left foot, it would make sense for him to remove the sneaker if it was causing him discomfort, but since it was a bitterly cold November day, I don't think he would have traveled far without wearing it. And the presence of bare footprints would suggest that Mark also removed his right sneaker at some point, but it was never found. Police bloodhounds did detect Mark's scent and traced it to a nearby road, which could indicate that he was abducted and left the area in a vehicle, but Mark had frequently visited this beach on previous occasions, so we have no idea if his scent was even left there on the same day he went missing. It's also worth noting that no other set of footprints belonging to an outside party could be found in the sand when the shoe was discovered. If things weren't confusing enough, when a photograph of the shoe was made public, a married couple came forward to police who told them they had seen that very same LA Gear sneaker on Sunray Beach on Sunday, November the 24th, the day before Mark went missing. Of course, the most logical explanation is that they were mistaken, but investigators thought the couple were sincere and genuinely believed they saw the sneaker on that particular date, as they said they had gone out for a walk before returning home to watch a Philadelphia Eagles football game that afternoon. But when the sneaker was found, it was positively identified by Maureen and Mark's brother Matthew, who had been the original owner of the shoe before he gave it to Mark. Given the circumstances, it really doesn't make any sense for Mark's sneaker to be on that beach the day before he disappeared. What we do know is that the shoe was not found until 9 p.m., about 5 hours after Mark was last seen, so an abductor would have had ample time to plant it there. Sadly, the beach was never sealed off as a crime scene, because at that point, the police still believed they were looking for a lost child and did not have any reason to believe that he had been kidnapped. There has been a recent push to perform new DNA testing on the evidence in this case, but the issue is that no one was thinking about that back in 1991, as the sneaker was handled by a number of different people after it was found and brought to the Heimbaugh residence so that Mark's family could identify it. It's possible that all of those people left traces of their own DNA on the sneaker, which could complicate further forensic testing. But on the other hand, if traces of Thomas Buttcabbage's DNA turned up on the shoe, that would be pretty damning, because he didn't even live in the area, and there's no innocent explanation for his DNA to be there. And while we're on the subject of DNA, the Where Is Mark book has a brief section which talks about a strange incident which took place the day after Mark's disappearance. A paper bag containing a thick folded blanket with bloodstains on it was found next to some trees in an outdoor strip mall located near the National Westminster Bank in Cape May. The bag was subsequently turned over to the authorities, but unfortunately, the book does not provide any follow-up on this, and it's unclear if this discovery had any connection to Mark's case. If investigators still have this evidence in their possession after all these years, I'd be curious to know if DNA testing could be performed on the blood to see if it belongs to Mark. However, getting back to the subject of Thomas Butcavage, the reason he popped up on the radar as a potential suspect is because of the story provided by sex worker Daniel Call, who claimed that Butcavage showed him a videotape where he sexually assaulted Mark and subsequently confessed to his murder. Even though Butcavage was living in Havertown, Pennsylvania at that time, which is 80 miles away from Middle Township, he told Call that he liked to drive great distances in order to abduct children from areas he had no connection to. So this provides a potential explanation for why Butcavage could have been in Middle Township on the day Mark went missing. Now, it might seem odd that Butcavage would screen a videotape of himself sexually assaulting a boy and then confess to murder, but he was a regular client of Call's and they often got together for sex, so perhaps Butcavage felt they had developed a close enough bond that he could trust him with his darkest secrets. Call never publicly shared his story until 2015, and since he was terminally ill at that point, I have a feeling he's no longer with us. But one reason I believe that Call is a credible witness is that he did not hesitate to go to the police after Butcavage showed him the videotape. Think about it. Call was a gay sex worker who serviced other men, which was technically illegal, and I think a lot of people in his position would not feel comfortable sharing that with the police, particularly back in 1993. Call was potentially causing great risk to himself by coming forward, so that should give you an idea about how genuinely disturbed he was by his encounter with Butcavage. Now, multiple searches of Butcavage's apartment failed to turn up this videotape, but I find it interesting that when he was questioned about it, he reportedly said, quote, "You'll never find it," rather than flat out denying that the tape existed. According to Call, Butcavage had attempted to recruit him as his new accomplice to acquire children, but when Call turned him down, it's possible that Butcavage became paranoid that Call would go to the authorities and decided to get rid of the videotape before they had a chance to search his apartment. I have to admit that part of me hopes that the story about the tape is false, because if not, then Mark or some other poor boy had to go through pure hell. If Butcavage did abduct Mark, who knows how long he might have been held in captivity and abused before he was killed. Now, when Butcavage attempted to recruit Call to become his new accomplice to acquire kids, he told him that the guy he ordinarily worked with had to be replaced because he kept screwing up. This detail is particularly important because if Butcavage was the long-haired man from the Ford Escort station wagon seen talking to Mark, then that means there was at least one other person involved in the abduction. The Morgans did confirm that there was a second man driving the vehicle, and while they didn't get a good look at him, they described him as being a thin man with pulled-back, stringy blonde hair. I mentioned earlier that in addition to the long-haired man from the station wagon and the man with the bushy eyebrows from the park, there also exists a composite sketch for a third man who was supposedly seen with Mark that day, but no details have been provided about the context of that sighting. Since this guy was described as having a ponytail and the driver of the station wagon had pulled-back hair, I wondered if they might have been the same man. However, the driver's hair was described as being blonde, while the other ponytailed man's hair color was dark reddish-brown, so he might be talking about entirely different sightings. But I would be curious to know if Butcavage or any of his known associates would have had access to a light-brown Ford Escort station wagon back in 1991. Of course, Butcavage has since gone to prison for sexually abusing other children, but as far as I can tell, he only seemed to have an interest in boys. So if Butcavage was the perpetrator, that only opens up questions about how the unidentified girl seen with Mark fits into everything, and if she might have been working alongside Mark's abductor or abductors. I guess the other strange lead we need to discuss is the anonymous phone call made in December of 2010 from a person who identified himself as the quote-unquote son of the witness of the crime, and said that Mark's abductor was named Gilbert Patrick Marie. Of course, all attempts to match that name to a person were unsuccessful, but I've always been intrigued by the usage of the phrase, son of the witness of the crime, as if they were related to someone who had knowledge or involvement in Mark's disappearance, but was not the main perpetrator. The call came from Philadelphia, which is in fairly close proximity to Havertown, so maybe he was the son of an individual who had some sort of connection to Thomas Buttcavage. However, it's worth noting that there's no mention of this phone call at all in the Where is Mark book, so perhaps investigators no longer believe it's a credible lead after all these years. Even though no direct evidence has ever been found to connect him to Mark's disappearance, I do think that Buttcavage seems like the strongest suspect, and there's a good chance that the man in the station wagon was him. We know that he has definitely harmed other young boys, and it's good to know that he's currently locked up and serving a 36-year prison sentence, but it's not a life sentence, and there is still a chance that Buttcavage could walk out of prison alive someday, so if he was responsible for murdering Mark, I'm not sure he has any motivation to confess. However, even if Buttcavage was the perpetrator, how many other people might have had knowledge or involvement in what happened? Did Mark just cross paths with the wrong person, or was there an organized effort to make him disappear because he knew incriminating information about child sexual abuse taking place in the area? Most disturbingly, was some of this sexual abuse being perpetuated by Mark's own father? The only real connection between Jody Heimbaugh and Thomas Buttcavage is the roommate of one of Buttcavage's sexual partners, who also happened to be the son of a member of Jody's barbershop quartet. Like I said earlier, that's a very thin connection, but I have to hearken back to that big reveal at the end of the Where is Mark book, where an anonymous woman told Richard McHale about a disturbing conversation she had with Jody back in 1995. Jody said he knew that Buttcavage murdered Mark, and mentioned how he got linked to him because the name of his barbershop quartet member's son was found in Buttcavage's address book. According to the woman, Jody then mentioned that he had, quote-unquote, told those guys not to write anything down on paper. Yes, this book reveals a lot of incriminating information which paints Jody in a suspicious light, but it's worth repeating that he has never been charged with any crime or made any public statement to address the accusations which have been made against him. However, if the story shared by Mark's girlfriend Robin is true, then what was already a very disturbing unsolved missing children's case has somehow become even more horrifying than anyone could have imagined. If Buttcavage did abduct Mark, then I'm guessing that he would have murdered him and disposed of his body outside Cape May County, so who knows where his remains might be. I can only hope that if Buttcavage is the guilty party, evidence can be found to implicate him before he finishes serving his prison sentence on the other child sexual abuse charges. I really don't know if Mark became the victim of a solo perpetrator, or if there was an organized conspiracy to make him disappear, but if there were multiple individuals involved, that only means there might be more people out there who know the full truth about what happened and can share important information that leads to a resolution in this case. Say what you will about Jody Heimbaugh, but Maureen Heimbaugh is continuing to remain a tireless advocate for her son and is still searching for answers after 3 decades. I've heard a number of interviews Maureen has done in recent years, and they are all pretty heartbreaking, so she deserves justice. So if you happen to have any information on the disappearance of Mark Heimbaugh, please call the Middle Township Police Department at 609-465-8700. That's 609-465-8700. Anyway, another special thanks to listener Julie Highland for narrating the opening of this week's episode. If you've already entered our listener voiceover contest before, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter and haven't already done so, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see featured on this podcast. Once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released another joint bonus episode with my friend Charlie from the Crime Lines podcast, in which we discussed a very famous case from Unsolved Mysteries that wound up being solved, the murder of Shannon Moore by her husband, Dave Davis. In addition, I've dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover another classic case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1987 murder of Don Smith. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to take a moment to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Christopher C., Kitty D., Martine and Karen, Alessandra P., Lindsay D., and Vanessa M. Thank you all so much for your support. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place at the Weston Park Central Hotel in Dallas, Texas, from August the 27th until the 28th. Myself and many other prominent true crime podcasts will be in attendance, and there will be a bunch of panel sessions, discussions, and live episodes. So in order to purchase tickets, please visit the website truecrimepodcastfestival.com. That's truecrimepodcastfestival.com. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶